University of Toronto. I work on a project called the Sprinova Legacy Survey. But today I'll be talking about, in general, how do you use supernovae to measure the expansion of the universe. So I'm an astronomer, and so I take it you all are mostly physicists, so if I use some jargon that you don't understand, just definitely raise your hand and say, what does that mean? Because if you're thinking it, probably a lot of other people are thinking it too. And since I do this every day, I often forget what I used to not know. So please let me know when you don't understand something. Okay, so the what are we talking about? Basically, in 99, late 98, two teams announced this incredible result that it looks like the universe is accelerating based on observations of type 1a supernovae. So the two teams were the HIZ supernova search team led by Brian Schmidt and Saul Perlmutter of the Supernova Cosmology Project on the right. So I used to be a member of the Supernova Cosmology Project, so you can see where my biases might lie. But basically, you know, at first everybody said, well, they'll figure out something was wrong with the supernovae, but the result has held up for about a decade now. And lately they've been winning all of these prizes, like this Shaw Prize, the Gruber Prize, and this other Italian prize, worth like, you know, $2 million or something like that. So, you know, sometimes you can really hit it big in science, I guess. Okay, so the results were that the supernovae looked like they were farther away than they ought to be if the universe did not have dark energy in it. Okay, so basically, you have redshift on the bottom, or you can think of that as the scale of the universe, and then magnitudes this way. Now, of course, astronomers use these silly units that were derived from what Greeks wrote down, so you have to deal with that. But basically, you know, of course, brighter is lower, okay, but essentially, you can think of it as relative brightness over here. What they showed is that the supernovae lie above this line, so in a universe without vacuum energy or without a cosmological constant was here, but all the supernovae are above that. So you need some other term to explain things. Okay, so something like this has happened before in astronomy. In 1846, astronomers noted that the position of Uranus was different than what it ought to be. Okay, and people were trying to figure out why that was, but Leverrier calculated that there should be another planet perturbing it, and tried to go out and convince other astronomers to look in this place. He actually had a hard time convincing people to go and look. But then, when people did, they discovered that it was because there was another planet there, Neptune. So basically, calculations were off. It turns out it was because there was a new physical thing in the universe that was undiscovered before. But a different situation happened with Mercury. So I'm sure you're familiar with the fact that the perihelion advance of Mercury was unexplained, and people couldn't figure it out. Leverrier himself said, maybe there's a new planet interior to Mercury called Vulcan. But it turns out that it wasn't a new physical component in that case. It was just that the law of gravity was wrong, right? It was relativity. So here's a case where the same kind of thing is going on, but in one case it's that there was just something that we had not seen before, you know, normal kind of physics, but an exotic component of the universe. And in another case, it's just that our conceptions were wrong about the physical law. So we're trying to figure out if this is the case right now with dark energy and dark matter. So there's two things that we, you know, our monkey brains have not evolved to understand because it doesn't do much on Earth, apparently. Okay, but we're trying hard. So, you know, we make up this tiny little slice here of the universe. The rest of it's composed by dark energy, if dark energy is in fact the explanation. Okay, so what is it? Well, here's just a review with 50, you know, in a paragraph, 50 different theories, but of course there are hundreds. So, you know, but be careful when fitting models to this data. I'm going to show you all of the sort of a lot of where the skeletons in the closet lie, I've seen, you know, physicists write these papers where they fit just, you know, arbitrarily complex functions to this data, which, you know, it has systematic errors and other potential problems. So hopefully you'll have a better feel for that by the end of this. Okay, so what do we know about it? Well, it acts like a pressure in the universe, making it expand, it accelerate. It looks like it doesn't clump. There's about 10 to the minus 26 kilograms per meter cubed in every cubic meter of space. So that's the equivalent of a few hydrogen atoms. So basically, there's not very much of this stuff. It's just that there's so much space that it adds up over cosmological distances. More dark energy in the early universe means galaxies spread apart faster, then they can't grow as quickly. And so the size of galaxies will change depending on how much galaxy, I mean, how much dark energy you have. And you can see these you know, beautiful models where people do this. It could also mean lower star formation. Maybe the metals wouldn't have built up to make us. So this stuff is not just an abstract thing. It's a thing that, you know, affected our evolution, the evolution of galaxies, and so on. So right now we're at the stage where we know nothing, you know, or almost nothing about it. So, you know, you want to ask the basic question. Put some dark matter in a box, I mean, some dark energy in a box, then what happens to it? You got some density of it. What kind of pressure does it exert? In other words, what's its equation of state? So you can figure that out by you take the Friedman equation, which just describes where A is just, you know, a scale in the universe, and then take the velocity, the ratio of the velocity to the scale, and you can write down, you know, H is just a Hubble constant. You can just write down how the different components of the universe will cause these cause the Friedman equation to change. So we know matter. It goes like A to the minus 3, of course, you know, normal density. Radiation gets an extra power of A because, you know, photon stretch. There's curvature, which may or may not exist. And then dark energy. So we don't know the equation of state yet, and we don't know how much. Well, we're starting to measure it. So we want to know, how does it dilute? You put some in a box, what happens to it? Okay. W, here's the equation of state, the ratio of pressure to density. Remember the scale goes like 1 plus z, redshift. Okay, so if W is minus 1, you get 0 for the exponent here. And then what does that mean? As the universe expands, it doesn't dilute, right? You get more dark energy, which is kind of crazy. Okay, but then and then we want to measure the amount as well. Okay, some other kinds of models, quintessence kinds of models, W greater than minus 1, can vary with time. Like I said, it could be new physics. So what we want to do is look back in time, make a map of the history of the expansion of the universe, and to do that, we need a standard candle. So, fortunately, we do have type 1a supernovae. Now, just to refresh your memory, of course, type 2 supernovae are core collapse supernovae, so they're just giant stars that get into their life, they collapse, they blow up, and make a black hole or a neutron star. Okay, but that's not what we're talking about. Those are not very standard. We're talking about type 1a supernovae, which happen. This is the most favored model, but we're not completely sure that it's right. A star overfills its Roche lobe, the potential surface, transfers matter onto a white dwarf, which is right down there in the center. And we think when it gets up to the Chandrasekhar limit, about 1.4 solar masses, carbon ignites and it blows up the white dwarf. So these are really bright, 10 billion suns shining all at once, and they're pretty much standard. Okay, so in greater detail, what we think happens is that, you know, there are two stars, and one turns into a red giant. It can accrete matter onto the other star. It loses its outer layers, and the inside is what becomes a white dwarf. And then the other one gets to the end of its normal life, becomes a red giant, and then this process happens again. Now, we're not sure if type 1a supernovae happen from this branch or from this branch, or both. Okay, it could be that the mass is accreted, like I just said, and it gets to the Chandrasekhar limit and blows up. Okay, and then this is just the other star that gets, you know, really screwed up in the process. Okay, but it does survive, we think. If this is the case, so people have been looking for stars that have survived supernovae that could be screwed up. There have been claims that one was seen in type of supernova remnant, but I don't believe it. Is there a question? Okay. Or it could be that you have two white dwarf stars that merge and then get to the chance to hear them that way, blow up. Okay. So we're making observations, constraining this picture right now. But it doesn't matter that we don't know what they are. We can still use them for cosmology because we can just do empirical corrections. So, of course, this is what, now this didn't come out very well, but this is a supernova over here, of course, and it can outshine its host galaxy. This case was supernova 1994D, and this is like a month after it was at the brightest, so it was much brighter. Okay, so to use supernovae, you need to use the luminosity distance. Now, we call it the luminosity distance to, you know, differentiate it from other kinds of distances. For example, parallax or other things. Now, different kinds of distances can have different powers of 1 plus c, depending on whether you use photons or not, for example. So, just take the observed flux. It's the luminosity over, you know, 4 pi distance squared from the inverse square of log light. Now, you just get a luminosity distance out of that. And you don't need to know the intrinsic luminosity because you can just compare relative distances. Okay. Now, in more detail, here is one example of for omega lambda, for the W equals minus 1 case, here's what the luminosity distance looks like. I mean, it doesn't matter the exact form. The fact is you can write it down, and you can generalize this to other forms, depending on what your model is for this, you know, this term. Okay, so here omega k is the curvature, of course, and now, so you can then calculate, you know, astronomers use these things, distance moduli, which is just the apparent magnitude subtracting the absolute magnitude. So, of course, absolute magnitude is just the magnitude at a certain distance. Okay, so then we can say we take our predicted distance modulus from the cosmology, and we compare it to our observed distance modulus from the observations, and then we take into account different sources of errors, like the fact that galaxies, the redshift isn't always a cosmological redshift. You can have motions from galaxies from gravity, locally, for example. And then get a chi-square, and we can make probabilities. Okay, and then when we do that, we get here the observations over here. Instead of the distance modulus, this is just the corrected magnitude because we want to take out any term that's associated with what we think the absolute brightness of the supernova should be, or the Hubble constant. So you just marginalize over these kind of nuisance parameters that don't matter. And you get the prediction, the observations, and then you can make these probability contours. So omega lambda, omega matter, where you take omega matter, and W. Okay, so what's the state of the art? Basically, like I said, the Supernova Cosmology Project and the HiZ Supernova team have been around for a while. They were the first to come up with these observations. The first didn't have a lot of color information, and then they slowly got some, but the light curves were kind of sparse, and they had a few supernovae. Then people have been pushing these to higher redshift, to go above redshift 1, using mainly the Hubble Space Telescope, but also ground-based observations. And that allows you to see when the dark energy, its influence wasn't as great, and matter was a greater component of the universe, so the epoch of deceleration. And then today, there's a team called ESSENCE and a team called the Supernova Legacy Survey, and we are beating them. Okay, so we think we're going to have like about 400 supernovae. We already have about 350. Yes?
I'm sorry, can you explain what the colors are?
Sure. So I is a filter, and I'll get to this in a second, but you know, infrared filter. R is a red filter, and the more colors you have, the better you're able to constrain, for example, dust in the and other correlations with color in the supernova. I'll get to that in a second, but G, R, I, and Z are just a different filter set, the Sloan filters. Basically, the more colors, the better. J is an infrared color, and you need that if you're doing higher redshifts, for example. Okay, so the more colors you have, the better. The higher wavelength range in general, the better, but not necessarily. And, of course, the more supernova you have, the better. So that's where we are right now. Okay, so how does it work? Well, we take a new image. We take a reference image that we took months ago or days ago. And in our case, we just sum up all the observations for the previous years. And we subtract the two. And you get something left over. Now, that's a supernova. So we do this on the same field all the time. So we have a roll-in search. So that means that every time you observe a field, you're discovering a new supernova, but you're also getting data points on all the other supernovae that have been discovered in that field. So we can build up these light curves, which are, this is the G filter, R, I, and every time you observe, you get these light curves, so we have hundreds. And you can see in here where there are gaps, where there are no observations, because that's where you have the full moon, and these observations are so sensitive that we can't do anything when there's a full moon. Okay, so the other thing is we need to make sure these are type 1A supernovae, so we have to get a spectrum, because these are so far away, of course, we can't resolve the supernova, there's point sources, and you need to look at spectrum to see what is there. So in the Oort collapse supernovae, in type 2s you have hydrogen, and in 1Bs you don't have much hydrogen, but you do have helium, which is the yellow lines here, and then in type 1Cs you might not have either, but you don't have much silicon. So we have to do this every time to classify them, and this tells us something about the physics of the supernova as well, which is, you know, this whole interesting trying to understand that. Yeah, sure.
So you said that these are standard sources.
Yes.
So do we have the nearby supernovae in our galaxy, again, compared with?
Yeah, so the close-by supernovae are from close galaxies. The last one observed in our galaxy was about 400 years ago. So, you know, we don't have any modern observations of anything really close. But the nearest galaxies, that is our sort of baseline set of supernovae that we calibrate the high region from. It's a little bit more complicated than that in the sense that you put them all together and you do the calibration all together. But the local ones, the difference between the local ones and the high region ones is really where we're getting a lot of this information on cosmological parameters. So doing that calibration where we are discovering supernovae at the highest regions using our camera, then we have to calibrate that relative to people locally have discovered supernovae using a whole, you know, all different kinds of observations. So that's a big problem, calibration is. Okay. So these are coming from supernovae and from galaxies, for example, the local group. I mean, not a little bit farther than the local group, but like Virgo and other kinds of galaxies, redshift less than 0.1. Okay, so we get imaging from CFHT, this telescope in Hawaii, every 4 days during dark time. And we make the discoveries, and we build the light curves. And then we get spectroscopy from all of the largest telescopes in the world. And then that tells us whether they're 1As or not. So here's an example of a high redshift supernova spectrum compared to a low redshift supernova spectrum. And you can see that they're the same. Oops. Okay, so here's one square degree field. This is what we start with, which is, it has, like, you know, it's in the Guinness Book of World Records as the largest digital camera, okay? But basically, it's gigapixels. And what happens is, well, almost every point here is a galaxy, right, which could be hosting a supernova, except for the things with spikes, which are stars. And then if we zoom in, things get a little, you know, you can start to sort of see that there are galaxies there, okay? And right here, there's going to be a supernova, okay? Right. So then this is after more than a month of observations. The supernova gets brighter, dimmer, turns redder, okay? So let's see how we use that information. Basically, different supernovae have different brightnesses depending on their basic properties. The ones that rise and fall quickly are the dimmest, and the ones that take a long time to rise and fall are the brightest. Okay, so we can use this information to correct them to make a standard candle. So There's one system of doing that. There's several different ways, but one is called Delta M15, which is in 15 days from the maximum brightness, how many magnitudes does light curve fall? Okay, so in that case, for the bright supernovae, they don't fall that much, but for the dim supernovae, they fall a lot. Okay, so higher delta M15s would be fainter. Okay, but in the system that we primarily use, it's called stretch. We just multiply this axis of the light curve by a constant called stretch, and then that stretches, and then the higher stretch is the brighter. Okay, and there's another method called MLCS, which just fits templates to these, but it doesn't matter what system you use, basically. Okay, so PowerPoint screwed up here, but basically we want to go from this to this to make them all a standard brightness, no matter what they start out as. And we use so we have our distance modulus equation, which is normally m minus m. We're doing it in the B band, which I'll talk about in a second. But what we do is correct for the stretch so that the dimmer ones, the narrower ones are dimmer, okay, and the broader ones are brighter, filling in this relation. And then we can correct for the color. Now, this should extend up here. It should be animated too. But basically, the redder ones are fainter, and the bluer ones are brighter. And we this C is a measured color, say B minus B. And we multiply that by some constant to make this correction.
What are the terms that they put in?
Okay, so basically, it's alpha is some constant that we just determine from this relationship, from the stretch. The stretch is the width of the light curve. Okay, so that's this relation. And then the color is just something that you measure from the B band and the V band, say, or you can use different colors. And you multiply that by some constant to correct for, I'll show you a better version of this later, but basically there's a relation here between absolute magnitude and color. So absolute magnitude, again, is just sort of the luminosity expressed as a magnitude. Okay, and this is the distance modulus, so it's just how far away it is expressed as a difference in magnitudes, basically. Okay, so here's some typical light curve. So as the supernova gets brighter and dimmer, we just trace this out, and here's the G band, the R band, and the I band. Now, these are the observed filters that we, measure from our perspective here on Earth. We fit these curves to them. This is how we measure the terms in this equation. So the colors, the difference in the peak magnitude here between these different filters stretches the width, and the peak brightness is NB here. In the rest frame, B band. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little more. Oh, one second. Okay, first of all, let's show you that these corrections actually do work. So here's not making any correction. Okay, here's if you make just a stretch correction, you improve the dispersion. This is the residual around the best fit cosmology. And then if you make both corrections, you improve the dispersion even more. Okay, so I keep talking about the fact that this is these filters and the rest frame and observer frame. Okay, what does that mean? Our filters are G, R, I, Z. So they are, here's in wavelength, here's bluer, here's redder, right? We've got the G band, the R band, the I band, the C band, and these are observed. You can sort of see these filter functions here. Okay. But the supernova is at a high redshift, its flux is redshifted out into other parts of the spectrum. Okay, so we have locally U, B, and V observations so that we know that supernovae are a certain brightness in U band with B band with the V band. Okay, but then we're observing the high redshift points, so we observe in a filter system that's redshifted from those, and then as the redshift increases, these filters, our observed filters, match up to rest frame filters in different ways, and we have to use those to map back to observer frame fluxes. So here's the SED, the spectral energy distribution, just the spectrum of a supernova at maximum light. Okay, and as this starts, I'll show you the way that these match up at different redshifts. So starting at redshift zero, the G-band filter here sort of overlaps with the V-band and sort of with B-band, but it's not a very good match, so it's hard to do anything there. But, oops, as the redshift increases, so the flux is getting stretched, it's getting redshifted, and the different filters are matching up differently, the U, B-band, V-band. So what we want to do then is take at, say, a redshift of 1.1, we want to take observations in the I-band and then convert those into the rest frame U-band and take observations in the Z-band and convert those to the rest frame B-band. So that's the K-correction, this correction. It's very important for us. It's one of the biggest sources of error in supernovae. So again, as we observe supernovae at different redshifts, they match up differently in different bands. And, of course, the spectrum of the supernova is changing with time. So at maximum light, this is zero. Here's this picture that I just showed you, the spectrum. But you observe it before maximum or after maximum, the spectrum changes. And this is a sort of standard 1A spectrum. But different ones have different perturbations on that, basically. So we have to use this to do these kinds of corrections that I just talked about. So, and by the way, those are generated from averages of hundreds of supernovae. Okay, so here is our latest result, which is using about, I think it's something like 240 supernovae. And here are our data points on top of this prediction, right? And you can see for a universe with no dark energy, omega lambda equals zero, it doesn't fit the data. And a matter-dominated universe, of course, really doesn't. And here are the residuals. Okay, so here are the red points are these local supernovae I was talking about before, and these are our observations. Okay, so then here are our best results from the supernovae observations, which are these contours crossed with the observations from the baryon acoustic oscillation results. And here the same thing, and across with W map free as well, W versus omega M. So we're getting a result that is consistent with W of minus 1 to about 6 or 7%. So that constrains some of the dark energy models. And lambda, which is, you know, W equals minus 1, Einstein's cosmological constant, looks like it's consistent with the data. Okay, so now that we're going to get to a 4 or 5% measure, we think, by the end of the survey. But the problem is systematic errors are now as important. They are about 5%. So, you know, we'll know that we're precise, but we don't know if we're on target. So this is one of the biggest, this is the name of the game in supernovae right now, basically. Is understanding all your sources of error. So, okay, a lot of these terms will be unfamiliar, so let's just go through a few. Basically, we've got just your general calibration kinds of issues. You know, you derive a zero point for your magnitude system. Make sure that your camera reproduces the same magnitudes, your setup, your TCDs, every day that you observe over this five-year baseline. Make sure you can convert them from the local supernovae and high redshift supernovae. You can put them on the same system. Okay. There's Malmquist bias, which is just basically the fact that in a magnitude-limited survey, brightness-limited survey, at the highest redshifts, the farthest ones away, you're only going to be able to find the brightest things, so you have to correct that. You could get, if you don't get the spectra, really good spectra, we're observing really difficult to observe things, they're noisy spectra, you're going to get contamination from other core collapse objects. These K corrections that I just talked about, if at certain wavelengths, you notice the filters matched up really well, but at certain other ones, they didn't. And you have to have a whole set of errors associated with that and the fact that different supernovae have slightly different spectra. There's other kinds of systematic errors, like, for example, the fact that galaxies locally have different velocities, and they don't trace the sort of cosmological redshift. And there's another thing called the Hubble bubble, which I'll talk about in a second. And the fact that supernovae can be lensed slightly. Okay, then there's extinction due to dust. This is the biggest problem, and we need to correct for this because dust makes supernovae redder and fainter. Then there's the fact that the supernovae have different properties depending on their environment, and you can get a different mix of supernovae as you go to higher redshift. We need to correct for that as well. Then there's the fact that supernovae properties themselves could be changing intrinsically, and we're investigating that. Okay, so let's just take a couple of these more interesting ones. Okay, so just experimental systematics. So we basically make a correlation matrix between each pair of things. Okay, so like how does magnitude, how does, say, stretch correlate with magnitude or color, etc. So you have errors associated with this, this, and this. You keep track of covariance between these for all the different supernovae. So here are 300 supernovae, and here's just an example covariance matrix for one pair. Okay, and then there are six of these for each pair here, and you know, here's the math. But basically, it's color coded so that these are the local supernovae and these are the high redshift supernovae. And okay, so you have to do that kind of thing. Then you see how those map onto changes in W. So if we're uncertain about our filter functions, we need to know exactly how much light our filter transmits, for example. And you can measure that in a laboratory, but then when you put it on a telescope, sometimes it's different. You have to measure it with, it's harder to measure when it's on the telescope. You have to do a bunch of observations of the stars and things like that. But that uncertainty doesn't affect us very much. But for example, if we get the zero point wrong, you know, we have to actually observe Vega, one of the brightest stars in the sky. Well, we don't observe it directly because our telescope's too big. But basically, you have to, that's what the system is defined on for the local supernovae. So you have to make sure that you can calibrate to that. Okay, because the zero point of the magnitude system is defined as Vega, basically. Okay, but if we get that wrong, it has a big effect on W. Okay, so another interesting thing is peculiar velocities of galaxies and this so-called Hubble bubble, etc. Okay, so what is this? The Hubble bubble is this Jha et al. Paper, they find that the Hubble constant, they find a 3-sigma decrease in the Hubble constant at 7,400 kilometers per second. So these galaxies out at, now this is just c times the redshift here. Okay, so these galaxies at a certain, you know, velocity appear to have a different Hubble, you derive a different Hubble constant if you use supernovae locally versus if you use supernovae a little farther away. And you can change this cutoff. And at about 7,400, they find a 3-sigma result that the delta Hubble constant over the Hubble constant is like 5% here. Okay, so, well, that doesn't make any sense, right? The Hubble constant should be a constant locally. Okay, why are we getting this? Well, they said, well, it could be some kind of local void in the mass density. And they conclude that it's a 6% systematic error on W, which is huge. Okay, that's the size of the our statistical errors. Okay, but problem is, when we use our fitter to do this, which is called SOLVE, they use their fitter, it went away. Okay, so what the hell is going on? Okay, well, it turns out that we found that it's related to how you treat extinction supernovas, how you treat dust. Okay, so the problem with treating dust is that supernovae are intrinsically, the supernovae that are intrinsically brighter are bluer. And then the supernovae that are intrinsically dimmer are redder. Okay, but at the same time, dust is doing the same thing. It's making the brighter supernovae, I mean, the add more dust, it's making supernovae dimmer and it's making them redder. So they try to separate this effect using what's called the multicolor light curve shape model. Okay, which is just like I was saying before with delta F15 stretch. It's just one of those. It doesn't really matter the details. But they assume an intrinsic supernova color distribution and then assume a dust extinction law. So assume the dust acts like it does in the Milky Way. And then apply that. Okay, so how does that work? Well, basically, here's the days since the maximum light, since the peak of the light curve. And here's the B minus B, which is the color of a supernova. And it looks like supernovae get to be sort of standard in color at about 40 days after maximum light. Okay, so then you can use that and say that any difference from this must be due to dust. And these were this was constructed from dust-free supernovae in elliptical galaxies with very little dust. Okay, so now, so that you get an intrinsic B minus B, and then any excess is your observed B minus B minus the intrinsic, and then that tells you the reddening. Okay, and then you use the way that we know how dust works in the Milky Way. You get this ratio of, this is A to B is how many magnitudes of brightness difference there is based on this amount of reddening, and this R to B value is about 4.1. And so you figure out how many magnitudes the supernova has been dimmed by dust. So this is the method used by most people. You don't have to use 40 gauge after maximum, but you can use these to develop relations at maximum light and so on. Okay, so this is what most people do. But that's what led to this Hubble bubble. Okay, so what we do is this empirical correlation that I just showed, that we just fit the data, whatever it is, and we do not impose a model. What this means is that we're blending these two effects, but it turns out they operate in the same direction, so it doesn't really matter. Okay, so we fit for this beta parameter, just like we fit for alpha and capital N here, and we see what that shows us. Okay, so here's another one of our fitters that we just developed called SIFTO, because it's Canadian brand of salt. But basically, we get, here's a color, B minus B, for example, and here's what the data say, and when you fit a line to the data, you get this kind of relation. So this is residual from the Hubble diagram if you don't make a color correction. So this is your color relation. Okay, now the dashed line is Milky Way dust, so B of 4.1. Okay, and so what they were doing was just assuming that this is true, not fitting it, okay? And here's this MLCS thing, and the relations are different. They were also using a prior, a Bayesian prior, that cut off all of their sort of negative things because they're posing this physical idea that's not a good idea, okay? Because there are supernovae over here. If you bunch them all up right here, you're gonna screw up your statistics. Okay, so here's this late time coefficient. Doesn't matter how you do it, basically. It's that if you use this law, you're going to get the correction problem. Okay, so the significance of this Hubble bubble is directly related to this value of beta. Like I said, Milky Way dust is 4.1. And if you use that, you get, no matter what fitter you use, you get this Hubble bubble. But if you fit it, you get something more like 2, and then you don't get a bubble. Okay, so that was an example of something that was a systematic error, but it wasn't, people thought it was a systematic error, but it wasn't, because it just turned out it was a different systematic error that was, coming in. So what they did is they double counted their systematic errors in their cosmology paper, this Woods-Vasey et al. Paper. But, okay, so we've learned something about supernovae, but what does that mean? Is exotic, is dust in other galaxies different than Milky Way dust? That seems hard to believe that it's that different. It could be that there's some property of supernovae that since you're fitting both, you just get a lower number. But that's a big area. Just in the last few months, people are investigating with type 1a supernovae. Okay, now there's population drift. Okay, so we know that supernovae in spiral galaxies and star-forming regions behave differently than supernovae in elliptical galaxies. Okay, well, why should that be? Okay, so here's the stretch distribution. Here's the A. Well, forget the fact that this is A component. This is just passive host. This is ellipticals. Here is the distribution of the stretches. They're lower than 1 here, okay? But for the star formers, they're higher than 1. Okay, that means that these are brighter, remember, and these are dimmer, intrinsically. So remember, we're making a stretch correction. So in principle, this should matter, but we have to be very careful about this, because as you go to higher redshifts, you get more star formation in the universe. So your balance of supernovae, of the types that you have, will shift. So we take we figure out the supernova rate from these what I call the delayed component here, because these take a long time to explode. That's why they're different in different hosts. And basically, these supernovae are proportional to the star formation rate. So this is, that's why they're in spiral galaxies, because spiral galaxies have star formation, and they produce these high-stretch supernovae. They, in other words, they're from fairly massive progenitors. The secondary star in the system is something like 6 or 7 or 8 solar masses, and so they die soon after they form. Okay, whereas these take forever to blow up. So these are maybe 2 solar mass progenitors. You know, our sun is going to live for 10 billion years. These may live for 5 billion or something like that. They blow up. So all of the star formation has gone out of these elliptical galaxies. And so anyway, what you can do is you can take the rate of these and the rate of these, and you can see that just from the star formation history of the universe from Hopkins and Beacon, as you go up higher in redshift, you'll get more star formation. You'll get a greater contribution to your total supernova rate from these star formers. And so that means you'll get more of these high-stretch ones relative to low-stretch ones. Okay. So here's what, this is from a recent paper of mine. If you take the local supernovae, the low redshift ones, you get this kind of predicted distribution based on that, on the rates and the previous stuff. That's the Gaussian here, and then the histogram is the actual data. Okay. And then as you go to intermediate redshifts, 0.1 to 0.75, where we're doing our stuff, you get a different mixture of this prompt and delay component, the ones from star formers and ellipticals, and then the data fit that. And then as you go to higher redshift, you expect more of these, and then so it seems to be actually, it's not just the, so the observations match the predictions from this model. Okay. So, conclusion, average stretch, and thus average intrinsic brightness of the supernovae is evolving with redshift. But like I said, if stretch correction works, that's okay. Does it? Well, okay, so here's where we've done that correction with supernovae in active galaxies, the ones with star forming, and the ones with passive galaxies with no star forming, and they seem to correct the same kind of average supernova like her. Okay, and then we can do the cosmology separately, with the supernovae just in the passive galaxies, the supernovae in the star-forming galaxies. And we get about the same thing. Okay, the big problem here is that there aren't that many, for the low redshift sample, there aren't very many supernovae in elliptical galaxies. And the corrections that's going on are a little bit different. So this is the subject of our latest cosmology paper that we're working on right now, and that will come out very soon. Okay, and if you want to split the supernovae by stretch, and you say, let's do the cosmology with just those that are low stretch, just the low brightness supernovae, and just the high brightness supernovae, you can show that you get the same relations, you get the same results. So, okay, so that worry seems to be pretty well taken care of. Okay, so now let's talk about, do the supernova properties themselves evolve? Okay, so remember this Chandrasekhar limit that I talked about, that theoretically a white dwarf star can't exceed 1.4 solar masses. That's just because of electron degeneracy pressure. You can only pack electrons so tight, and right before you get to that limit, if you add mass to that white dwarf, the carbon will ignite. And it's a degenerate star, so it can't expand to relieve this pressure and so on, and the temperature, just, you get a runaway explosion and it blows up the star. Okay, so I'm going to talk about our case that we think there was a supernova that was above this Chandrasekhar limit. So how do we figure this out? Well, we can measure the kinetic energy of the explosion. That happens because in the initial explosion, you get this fusion that goes through the star and blows it up, and it unbinds the star. Okay, so that's where you get the kinetic energy from the initial explosion. You get carbon and oxygen burn. They undergo fusion to get to intermediate mass elements like silicon, sulfur, magnesium, calcium. And in the densest regions, it burns all the way up to the iron peak, which is nickel, cobalt, and iron, the point at which you can't get any more energy out of the reaction, so it stops there. Okay. But what makes the supernovae so bright isn't that energy of the explosion. It is the fact that all this nickel that you just created about 6/10 of the solar mass of nickel decays from nickel 56 to cobalt 56 to iron 56. So if you took a supernova and converted it to nickels, it would be like $12 million, okay, but $13 million Canadian. But basically, it's a crazy amount of nickel, and that's why they stay quiet for a month. It's not the energy from the explosion, but the kinetic energy comes from the explosion. Okay, so we just had this paper, like I said, which showed that this one was sort of too bright. So that this is our supernova right here. Here's the luminosity, and here is the amount of nickel inferred from this explosion. So here, normal supernovae, like I said, the average is something like 0.6, but some get to almost a solar mass of nickel, some produce just a little bit. And remember that the white dwarfs we think are 1.4 solar masses. Well, we know that that's the limit. Okay. So if this is 1.3 solar masses of nickel, that's too much because you actually need other elements that we see in the spectrum of the supernova. You need all these intermediate mass elements and all of these unburned material as well. So when you total it up, you get something like it needs to be about a 2 solar mass explosion. And white dwarf stars are not supposed to be able to get that big. There's another line of evidence which comes from the kinetic energy, which is that if you take the kinetic energy that you expect as you increase the nickel mass, you get these, different lines here. Okay, so if you don't burn as much carbon, you know, some of the material is not burned in the explosion, you can get lower kinetic energy because, hey, you're not burning everything, right? And if you convert more stuff to nickel, the more thorough your burning is, you get more kinetic energy, and that increases the expected velocities that you see in the ejecta. Okay, so this is for normal supernovae. For a Chandrasekhar mass models, you get this series of models here. But in our case, we have this observation way over here, and it turns out that the velocities were much lower than you would have expected. Now, if you are increasing the amount of nickel, you should get higher velocities, but instead this was one of the lowest velocity supernovae ever seen. So, in fact, it fits a 2.1 solar mass model. Okay, so now, remember that from the light curve, we got about 2 solar masses. From the kinetic energy, we get about 2 solar masses. So it's 2 independent pieces of evidence that this supernova actually did have. It did not obey the Chandrasekhar limit. So it's a super Chandrasekhar. Okay, so what have we learned? Well, basically that supernovae do make good standard candles, but and you need them to probe dark energy. But and you know, dark energy right now is consistent with the cosmological constant, but lots of other models still fit. But supernovae do care about their environment. In different galaxies, they produce different kinds of supernovae. And we need to take that into account because they change with time. There is no such thing as a Hubble bubble, apparently, but it is a cautionary tale that the way you treat dust really does matter, and it can really affect your cosmology. But it could be that other dust out there is strange. And there are really strange supernovae out there. It could be that our theory of supernovae is it needs some patching up, or maybe there's some other crazy thing going on. In this case, we think it could be because, for example, 2 white dwarfs could be merging, and those could go over the limit. Or it could be that rapid rotation of the white dwarf could allow you to go beyond the Chandrasekhar limit. Although, theoretically, people aren't sure about that right now. People are trying to figure it out. But basically, there are all kinds of pitfalls with using Type 1A supernovae. But every time one comes up, we try to get it under control. And we still think that they're excellent standard candles, and they're our best probe of dark energy. That's it. gotta have something.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I have a question that the data also can fit vacuum universe. That's right.
Vacuum universe?
Yeah. Empty universe.
Okay, empty universe, right.
Yeah. So are there any, like, some exotic ideas why this could be?
I think that's much more of a general philosophical idea, just like, oh, let's test this, just see what it would look like. It's not, I don't think people think that there, we know that there's matter in the universe. We know that there's, 0.3 solar mass matter. Now, whether or not you could have some other universe that's empty, I don't know. Who knows?
So, if the large cost depends on nuclear decay and the phenomenon of the supernova itself is kind of a critical phenomenon, then I presume the data depends very extremely on all sorts of fine tuning, like if you have like some small change in the fine structure constant or whatever, would completely change the data.
Well, okay. For one thing, it's important to realize that this business about the decay is theory, but we know that it works. I mean, we don't know that it works, but it's a really good match for the data. But our cosmological results do not depend on this decay. So basically, we're just doing an empirical correction based on the brightness that we see and the properties that we see of the supernova. And it doesn't matter what is going on. Under the hood, basically. This is just to infer the properties of this one supernova. And if it were really close, like something you could get different with a different fine structure constant or something like that, I would never have concluded that, this thing has to be above the Chandrasekhar limit. It's just because it was so far above that, it was clear that there was something odd going on. But it is a good idea. It would be, an interesting theoretical paper if you change the fine structure constant to, some, what would happen in this. The answer is not very much, but it would be interesting to look at. But the other sources of error, like I said, about color corrections, dust, and everything else like that, would dwarf those kinds of effects. And, basically, physically, what's going on in a supernova, this is a very complicated kind of explosion. And it could well be that works differently in the high-redshift universe when you have, for example, less metals. So, your heavier elements, you haven't had as many star cycles, so you haven't produced as many, and that could affect the physics of the explosion. Of course, we're looking at that right now too. We don't see any evidence of that, but those kinds of things probably play a much bigger role. But you're right that it is important to think about all the ways that physics could be different in the highest redshift universe.
How much more nickel is in that explosion?
So this was 1.3 solar masses, and normally it's about 0.6, so it's more than twice as much, 2.1 times as much nickel, basically, as your average.
So it could be like two supernova happening at the same time.
Yeah, I thought about that too, but it can't be. So, but that's one of the first things. You're like, ooh, maybe it's two. But we have seen two in a galaxy before, but in this case, from the spectrum, and the way that the light curve works, everything else like that. I mean, I suppose it could be an insane coincidence of two that were, spatially coincident, exactly time coincident, and, everything else like that. But, it's very improbable, I would say, because any offset would blur the way things showed up. And the fact that the spectrum showed these very narrow lines. I didn't show the spectrum here, but it was obviously a 1A, but different in the sense that the kinetic energy was lower, the velocity was lower, and so if you had two supernovae, you would get the same. It would be broader, not narrow. So,
is there any evidence for the equation of the changing
So, the problem is right now we don't have good enough data to really have a good measure of equation of state changing in time. Of course, that's the holy grail. That's what we'd like to do. There, Adam Riess, with his high redshift supernova data, has been looking at this. You need basically higher redshifts than we have in our survey, but you combine the data from our survey with these other surveys and you produce this. So he is looking for that, but basically the data still aren't good enough to train any models very seriously. Now, what it takes is essentially hundreds of supernovae that Richard's created one. And he has about 30 or so. And the problem is he's using KCS on Hubble Space Telescope, but then of course now KCS has died. So he can't get any more data. And the other group that I was associated with, still am, the Supernova Cosmology Project, is also trying this. And again, without ACS, it's hard. But you can use ground-based techniques, but it's very, very, very hard. It takes heroic kinds of efforts. Like, you have to integrate all night on an 8-meter telescope to get one data point, you know, and then you need, you know, dozens of data points, like I showed. So to get one supernova, to get one point on a Hubble diagram, you have to use the world's largest telescopes for incredible amounts of time. Very hard. People are, of course, talking about building satellites to do this. SNAP is one idea. JDEM is generally the, you know, the umbrella dark energy program, but one of the proposals is SNAP, which is to get 2,000 supernovae at redshifts up to 1.7, measure the equation of state, any possible changes in time. So, a very important point, of course, is that even though the dark energy looks consistent with the cosmological constant, it may not actually be a cosmological constant. It could be, you know, an evolving model that just happens to look like W plus minus 1 right now. Other questions? Okay. Talk to you later.